Okay, so I have settled the rooms for the exam and for the question and answer session. Bausch and Lomb 109 is the lucky room. So just a reminder, the exam's at 8 in the morning next Tuesday, and the Q&A session is going to be Monday. The spirit of that is I'll try to answer anything that you want to ask. Another reminder, I mean, I can sort of understand you need a little time to talk as a group, and you need to, you might be distracted by the test and other tests you have. But I would like you to meet with your group and begin to think about your presentation, because the only issue is, I mean, this exam is the 16th, and then it's not that far to Thanksgiving, and then when Thanksgiving is over and you're back, it's like this really steep, slippery ride into the finals. So it's lots of things are due, and it'd be a good idea if you at least start thinking about it, and if you can, it'd be good to have the initial meeting with me next week. Okay, so any questions about any of that? Any issues with the exam? Questions? Okay. We've tried. Oh, sorry. Thank you. I told you AAA, and I meant AA. I'm so sorry. It's not you. You have no.
Are you sure that?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. No, you asked, and I just told you the wrong thing. So I'm sorry. And you might want to bring spares for up here, which is why I'm bothering you, because there aren't any. Okay, so we've tried on several occasions to get this demo to work, and finally Tang and I connected on what I was after. So this is an RLC circuit, and what you have here is the source voltage. And of course it's oscillating because it's an AC source. And what you see here is the voltage that's across the L and the C, and it's minimal right now. And what is measured up here is the current in the circuit. Okay? And remember that when we have the frequency of the source matches the LC resonant frequency. How do I say that right? When it's the right frequency for the LC oscillations, the natural frequency of the LC circuit, then we get a maximum in the current, because in the impedance there's the two terms that involve the inductive reactance and the capacitive reactance that cancel out, and you're left with only 1 over basically the resistance as measuring of the resistance as opposed to these capacitive and inductive pieces. So what happens with the current as you scan through omega is you get a spike in the current. Okay, hopefully that'll work. Thank you. All right, so now what I'm going to do is change the frequency of the voltage. So as I swing this knob, notice that the larger oscillatory function changes in its frequency, so it's going to get compressed or contracted, right? Because remember, frequency is a measure of how often you oscillate in a second. Since you're scanning over time, you can think of this as a measure of the wavelength. So as you go to higher frequency, you get shorter wavelength. So as I change this, you can see the wavelength changes. Note also that the voltage across the L and the C minimizes at a certain point. Okay? And if you look, when this is a minimum, you see the current here is measured around 1.97, 1.96. If I go one direction, notice the current is dropping. and the voltage across the LC is getting bigger. If I go back the other way, I go through a maximum in the current, which is the resonance condition, and the voltage across the inductor and the capacitor is zero. And now I go through the other way, and now you see the current dropping again. So we're scanning in omega, and what you see is that the current actually peaks and spikes. And at the same time it peaks, you have a minimum voltage across the inductor and the capacitor. Basically, they cancel each other out. Is that exciting or what? All right. Any questions? Boy, tough crowd today. Okay. So just a reminder of some of the stuff we did last time. We talked about magnetism in materials, and it's a little more complicated than it was when we dealt with electricity or electric fields in materials. In this case, there's sort of three basic categories that we deal with: paramagnetic materials, diamagnetic materials, and ferromagnetic materials. So in paramagnetic materials, there is no magnetism naturally, okay, but you do have inherent little magnetic dipoles in the material itself. And as you add an external field, you linearly get, with the strength of the external field, more and more of the little dipoles along the direction of the field. And because they're little magnetic dipoles, you can think of those little loop currents, their individual magnetic fields will add to the external magnetic field, so that you will get a stronger magnetic field in the region that actually can come out of here as stronger over here. So it's a little different from what happens with the electric field. But inside the material, you certainly have a stronger magnetic field. In diamagnetic materials, we have something very strange, and you can sort of think of it as the magnetic field induces currents in the material in such a way that they fight the magnetic field. But I warn you that that's sort of thinking classically, because classically you would have to have a changing magnetic field externally for that to really be true induction. So there's more going on here, and I'll just warn you and not say anything more about it. But what happens is, in diamagnetic materials, with less strength than you get with the paramagnetic materials, you get an induced dipole moment in the material that opposes the external field. It is not sufficient to turn it off unless you actually have a superconductor. It's sort of a different thing, but you can have some opposition in here. And so B gets weakened. These are diamagnetic materials. Ferromagnetic materials, you have material that has both a very strong unpaired electron, so it has a strong magnetic moment in and of itself, like an iron atom. And in addition to that, you have sort of this crystalline lattice that allows for these, I mean, because you have the strong atom-to-atom interaction, you get these domains where you have largely alignment in certain directions. Again, as you now apply an external field, these domains will begin to shift for sort of the same reason you have here, but they talk to one another, so you get sort of the domain shifting together. And these domain walls begin to break as they, you know, they're all sort of joining in the same direction, and you get a stronger and stronger field. You get more of them, and they have stronger magnetic moments themselves, so you get a pretty strong field in here. And basically you get saturation roughly at 2 tesla in terms of field strength and how you align these things. So you can quantify this with a lot of different ways. Basically, you put a constant in front of the external magnetic field, and this now changes linearly, but you want to set it up so that it can both go larger than 1, so you're increasing the strength, and less than 1, but positive, so that you can decrease the strength of the field. And you can do that using the magnetic susceptibility here, which can be positive or negative, but not beyond negative one. And you can call this the relative permeability, or you can just combine all of this into a quantity which we call mu, sort of similar to epsilon in the electric field case, which is just the permeability. And I forget what is typically used in your textbook, but you may see any of them, so you need to see them all. And again, the sign can change. So for paramagnetism, the field gets a little bit larger. For ferromagnetism, the field gets a lot larger because of the material. And for diamagnetism, you get a less than get a little strength is less because of this weird crystalline aspect in iron. As you adjust these domains, they have some staying power in their orientation. And if you change the field back, they don't immediately go back. And basically, this is what makes a permanent magnet. If you put a chunk of iron in a very strong magnetic field and you remove it from that magnetic field, you still have things aligned, so you have a permanent magnet. Okay, it will weaken a little bit with time. Some of the domains will go away, but you still have a basically this memory, and so this means that it's difficult to trivially tune the magnetic field in a chunk of iron. But it's a material that's easy to sculpt. I mean, you can sculpt steel very nicely. It's a well understood. There are lots of different alloys. You can get good magnetic characteristics out of it, and it's cheap. So for a little bit of current, you can get a strong field in the iron because you're aligning. You're getting all these little dipoles to work for you. So it's something that you will see in, a lot of the time in instruments and everything. And you honestly, if you're thinking of designing an experiment, you want to run for the door when somebody mentions the word superconductor until you are convinced there's a good reason why you can't use an iron core magnet. Because superconductors, and at least until we get, right now they involve a lot of problems. I mean, you have to keep them cold. That's a big issue, actually. So, and so you might have power issues as to why you need to do it. Or you may need field strength issues. If you want to go to a very strong field, it makes a lot of sense to use a superconductor. At any rate, so there is this lag, so that you have to be aware, or you have to account for the history of the magnetic field and of the iron in the magnetic field. So if you plot the external field versus the field in the iron, you'll get some curve sort of like this that gets laid out. As you increase the field, you start to align the domains, and the domains work for you, so the field in the iron gets stronger and stronger relative to the external field. It's stronger than what you have for the external field. But it saturates, and then if you reverse the external field, there's a lag. So you can go all the way down to the field of zero, and you still have a strong field. So this would be the permanent magnet, right? That would be, I put it in a strong field, I take it out, and I still have a strong field. It's not 2 Tesla, but it's still pretty decent. And you have to reverse the field in order to begin to reverse the field in the iron, and then that saturates. So you have to take this into account if you're going to know what the field is. You all right with that? Okay, so then we started talking about the next major step in the class, which is basically examining more carefully everything that we've talked about up until now. And you'll recall Ampere's law. If we look at everything that we've had so far, we have Gauss's law. We have Gauss's law for magnetism, where you can't have a magnetic charge, so this term is zero. We have Ampere's law without this term. We've learned it with this term, where this is the integral of the current density through the area of the loop that we have in Ampere's law. So this is the I enclosed through the loop. It's just in a different form here because we'll want it that way in a little while. Faraday's law you've seen, and now you've got some sort of tantalizing almost symmetry in these equations. And if you look at it, for example, you have this term, but this term is really quite different because this is a current density, not an electric field. So it'd be interesting in a place where you have no currents to see what you have here. In fact, if you had no currents, you'd have zero over here. Anyway, Maxwell looked at this situation because you can have this situation where you have capacitive plates and wires, and you can have a current running through it, and you can have a region. Mathematically, in Ampere's law, this is your curve, and you have to have the current go through that curve, but what you really have to have is for that current to go through the surface that curve is the boundary for, and you can imagine that surface looking like this, in which case you actually have no current penetrating it. And so Maxwell came up with a term that fixes this, which he calls the displacement current, where if you have a current here, you're going to change the charge on these capacitive plates, which will give you a changing electric field between those plates. And so you might imagine then that you want this. You have this is zero. If you use this surface, the current through that surface is zero. And you want to have something that will change with the time derivative of the electric flux through that surface, which is what this is, okay? And then you choose the constant so everything works out nicely. And so Maxwell then added this term to Ampere's law in order to satisfy this particular piece, so that this particular issue, so that here we have the full-blown Maxwell's equations, and these are known as the integral form of Maxwell's equations. Do you have any questions on that? Okay. So now we're about to jump into some real fun. It's interesting to me that pedagogically you almost always learn everything up to now using the integral form of Maxwell's laws, Maxwell's equations. They work very nicely, intuitively, in learning about them individually. Gauss's law makes sense in the integral form. I mean, it's just sort of a nice way to do it. There is a different way of looking at them, which you will pretty much look at them as from now on. And you will often to the point of almost forgetting the integral form of Maxwell's equations. There's a much better way to look at things in terms of executing, for when you want to use Maxwell's equations to figure out what they really mean and what you can do with them, we want to go to a different mathematical form, and it is pretty much what you'll use from now on, and it is called the differential form for Maxwell's equations. Okay? Now, to get at the differential form, I'm going to use what we formally call vector calculus. All right? And you've seen maybe a touch of it. I'm going to define some things as we go. I'm going to use some theorems, and I'll probably... Well, some of you may begin to feel a little uncomfortable at first. Let me tell you the spirit of what I'm trying to do. I'm not going to throw on the final a problem where you have to derive using vector calculus some crap like I'm about to do, okay? That is not the spirit of what I'm doing. I'm going to do this for two reasons. One, you need to begin to be exposed to this, because in your next class or the class after that, they're just going to start pulling this stuff out, and that at that point you're going to have to get very comfortable with it and begin to use it. Okay, I'm not really expecting to begin to use it, but I do want to expose you to it. You may have seen a little bit till now, I don't know. The other reason I'm doing it is it's certainly not above you. You should be able to follow more or less. I'm going to throw out a couple of and then it was said that this theorem is true or whatever. But other than that, I want you to more or less follow along what I'm doing so that you feel that there's some plausibility to what we're about to see and pull out of Maxwell's equations. Okay? So that's the spirit of it. Okay. So the first thing I want to do is to define something. We've got vector fields all over the place. We've got the electric field, the magnetic field, and we have used a couple of times, we've used something which I'll remind you is this operator, del. And remember that we defined del as a vector operator, so it has three components like any vector does, but instead of scalars, it's got derivatives as the three component pieces. So the derivative, the change with respect to x in the x direction plus the change with respect to y in the y direction plus the change with respect to z in the z direction. But actually this needs to be in the z direction. Okay. I want to define this quantity. If I operate using the dot product on a vector field, remember what happens when we use A dot B? We get A in the X times B in the X plus A in the Y times B in the Y plus A in the Z times B in the Z. Right, you take each component, you multiply them by each other, and you add it up. But this is now a number. It's a scalar. Okay? So we're going to do this operation, but now instead of using a vector A, we're going to use this vector operator, del. And because of the mathematics here, A dot B is equal to B dot A. But that's not necessarily going to be true here because this involves derivatives. Okay? So we're going to use the same rules, though. I'm going to take the x component of del and multiply it by the x component of the vector v, the vector field. So this is the derivative of v in the x with respect to x plus the derivative of v in the y with respect to y, plus the derivative of v in the z. With respect to z. Right? And it is a scalar, just like we have for the normal dot product. And we call this the divergence of the vector field. Or just the divergence for short. And it might be, maybe it behooves us to go a little bit more formally. If I take the del dot v, remember that del is the derivative of x in the I plus the derivative with respect to y in the j plus the derivative with respect to z in the k. And we dot that into v in the x in the I plus v in the y, j, plus v in the z direction, k. Right? And now if you use that I dot I is equal to j dot j is equal to k is equal to 1, oops, we are not in units of 1 equals 0. Or I dot j and all the other combinations where they're orthogonal is equal to 0. Okay. So now all you have to do is spread things out. So this term times that term gives you this, because I dot I is just 1. But this term times this one or that one is 0. And that same is true for the other terms. Okay? Now, so maybe this looks like we have taken something that seemed sort of simple like a vector field and managed to make something really screwy here. Divergence is a very descriptive term for what this does. I mean, look at what it's doing. It is asking, to what extent does the X component of V change in the X? To what extent does the Y component of V change in the Y? And to what extent does the Z component change in the Z? In other words, it's looking for the degree to which this field is strengthening or weakening as you go out in the relative directions. A way to think about it is asking how much the field diverges or converges. So a field that is doing something like this has a positive divergence because it's sort of moving away. It's diverging from itself. The field lines are diverging. If they were coming together, it would have a negative divergence. A field that's parallel like this has zero divergence. Right? The field component in each of the directions is not changing. So that's zero. This is positive divergence. Sometimes you will see this written also as DIV of the vector field. All right. So you can think of if there is a source for the field, such as an electric charge, for an electric field, right? If you have a point charge, the field is always going out like that or in. Then you will clearly have a non-zero divergence. If you have a field that is constant, there is no divergence at all, so you'll have zero. All right? Now, this is also, I should point out, this is in Cartesian coordinates. There will come a time that you'll have to do this in other types of coordinates, and it looks a little different. The del looks different in spherical polar coordinates and stuff like that, and it's just guaranteed to make some days in your future miserable learning that one. But so be it. Your intuition can be governed by the Cartesian thing, I think. All right. Now I'm going to say, and then there was this, okay, in vector calculus. There is a theorem that I want to make use of, which it's possible you've seen it in your math classes, and it's not actually crazy, but I want to use it. It goes by the name of Gauss's theorem, or Green's theorem, and why we have all the ors here, I don't know. Sometimes it's called the divergence theorem. And this theorem says that if you integrate over the volume of some region the divergence of the vector field, so you're sort of doing an integral of the degree to which this field has a source or is diverging from a point, then that will be equal to the integral over the surface of that same volume of the vector field dotted into the area, which is the flux of the field through the surface right here. So what you're saying is if I sum over the entire divergence, which is really a measure of how much is the field emerging or converging into this volume, I am actually measuring the flux of the field through the surface that subtends the volume, which I think makes some intuitive sense. Now, I'm not proving it to you, and I can't even remember why I'm not proving it to you. either it's a complete pain in the butt and I decide it's probably because it was a complete pain in the butt and I decided it wasn't worth the pain for us. I don't know. Have you seen it in math classes? Some yes. Lots of yes. Some no. Okay. All right. Anyway, this is a very useful thing. So what I'd like to do is now use it. Let's start with Gauss's law. The integral of E dot dA is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. And if we use Green's theorem, then the integral of E dot dA over the surface, okay, the left-hand side of Gauss's law, by Green's theorem, is equal to the integral over the volume of the divergence of E. And of course, that's still equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. But what is Q enclosed? Q enclosed is the integral of rho dV over the volume, divided by epsilon naught. Right? So these are both the same volume integrals, which means the inside has to be equal. So that leaves us with del dot E is equal to rho over epsilon naught. So this would be Gauss's law in what we call differential form. And now I hope that the word differential begins to make sense, because remember, what is this? This is that sum of derivatives. Okay? Now, there is an intuition here, right? If you have point charges in there, you are going to have a diverging field. That's point charges. If you're in a region where there are no point charges, there will be no divergence of E. Okay? That, right, remember that the charge outside of the surface doesn't matter. So that's sort of the same statement here. So we can take the magnetic statement of Gauss's law, the integral of B dot dA, the other Maxwell equation, is equal to zero, and we can go through the same steps. This says that the integral of B dot dA over the surface is equal to the integral of del, using Green's theorem, is del dot B times dV over the volume, which is equal to zero. So that means that del dot B is equal to zero. And that would be the differential form for the magnetic field. So the statement that there is no such thing as a magnetic monopole is also a statement that the divergence of the magnetic field is zero. Pick any point you want with a magnetic field. Field comes, field goes. Even if you choose the dipole itself, you've got field emitted and coming in. So the divergence is always going to be zero, unless you have a magnetic monopole. Okay? Throughout our work, we have used the dot product, right, on lots of things. The other thing we've used are cross products. So the fact is, now that we're sort of dealing with vectors and we have this vector operator, what I'd like to look at now is if you actually take the cross product of a vector field with this vector operator. And that kind of beast is known as the curl. So we symbolize that as curl V, which is the same thing as del cross V. Okay? Just like a cross product, you will expect this to be a vector quantity. All right? So let's first look at this in Cartesian coordinates. Well, let's only look at this in Cartesian coordinates. All right, I have to tell you it's in Cartesian. And now we have del cross V. And we use the same rules you would use for evaluating this with just two vectors. We want to evaluate this determinant, where we have the upper row being the unit vectors in the x, y, and the z direction. And then below that, in the middle row, we put the components of del, so the partial derivative with respect to x, the partial derivative with respect to y, and the partial derivative with respect to z. And then below that, we put the components of the vector v, so v in the x, v in the y, and v in the z. Okay, and now we evaluate the curl this way. And if you recall evaluating the curl, the first term is I hat, and it's going to be I hat times this minus that. And although I'm now going this way, this is partial derivative with respect to z. I mean, you want to actually let this operate on VZ and this operate on VY. So we have I hat times the derivative with respect to Y of VZ minus the derivative with respect to Z of VY minus J hat. Now, if you use the J hat term, you take this piece times that, and this piece times minus that piece times that. So we have the derivative with respect to x, vz, minus the derivative with respect to z, vx, plus k hat. And k hat multiplies this times that minus this times that. So we have k hat is going to be multiplying the derivative with respect to x, vy, minus the derivative with respect to y, vx. All right. Now, since this is physics, right, obviously this is trivial, and I'm sure you all have a very fine intuition as to what this is now meaning, right? Of course, yes. At this point, you got all these derivatives and things, and I have no idea what this is actually saying, okay? So let me tell you what your intuition should be, although it really isn't so obvious to me when I just look at the math on this one. And I don't know how to make that feel a lot better for you, although, I mean, maybe there's a way. This is in the x direction. You're sort of asking how much does z change in the y and y change in the z, and that's all sort of in the plane around x a little bit. In the y direction, you're asking how does the z and the x components change, the z and the x and the x and the z. And in the z direction, it's the y and the x, and the x and the y. So there's some weirdness about in this direction, you're asking what's going on in these directions, sort of, okay? And we call this the curl. And it measures the degree of circulation of the field. About a point. So you can have the curl at every point in this vector field. In some places you can have curl, in other places not, in principle. If you have a point P here, and the vector field sort of has some degree of rotation about that point, you would have a large non-zero curl. And this is a vector, right? So the way in which it curls about that point, just like you have a spinning wheel, remember, how do you define the orientation? How do you define angular velocity? With a vector, even though you think of it as sort of the speed of this stupid wheel, right? But that wheel could be spinning this way, it could be spinning that way, it could be spinning in this plane, it could be spinning in that plane, and it can do all sorts of stuff. So if you're going to define the angular velocity, you have to have something that takes all of that into account. And so we use the angular velocity vector. If the wheel is in this plane and it is rotating like this, you have a vector that goes like so. And if that vector, if the wheel changes the plane, the vector changes its direction. So the vector is normal to this plane of rotation, which defines the plane of rotation for you, right? If it's rotating the other way, the vector's the other direction. So that angular momentum vector, the angular velocity vector, is really an amazing beast because it gives you a lot of information there. The length of the vector tells you how fast it's spinning. So it's very powerful. That's what you're getting here too. If you have a lot of curl in this plane, then you're going to have a curl vector this way, just like an angular velocity vector, right? And if it's a lot of curl, it'll be a long vector. If it's a little bit of curl, it'll be a little bit of little vector. If it's curling the other way, your vector will go the other way. Okay? So you can sort of think of this as the degree to which, at that point, the field is acting like a wheel a little bit. If you have this, you'll have zero curl. Here you have a large curl. If you have a field that is coming from a point source, you will have zero curl. Right? So I mean, you immediately look at that and go, okay, that means the curl of the electric field from some charge is going to be zero, right? Yes? Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's still the cross product. It's just you're doing a cross product with this weird sort of vector thing. Okay. So now that we've defined the curl, I want to pull out another theorem, and this theorem we'll call Stokes' theorem. And Stokes' theorem says that if we look at if we take the integral of v dot dl, so just like we've done with e dot dl in induction, right? You assume a loop and then you ask, then you sum up all the little electric field dotted into dls all the way around. So if you have a net circulation sort of around this loop, you'll get a non-zero contribution here. Okay, so now that we have some other measure of circulation with this curl, then maybe it won't surprise you to know that if you integrate the curl of this vector field around the surface dotted into dA, that these two are equal. Right, they're both sort of a measure of how much does this field sort of rotate in this plane or along the surface. Okay with that? Again, I'm not proving it to you, but I hope it sort of looks plausible. So one way to picture this would be, suppose I have some region where I have a loop like that, and let's say that within this region I have some vector field that fills it. And within that vector field, at every point in the field, there's a non-zero curl. So as strange as it may seem, you sort of have these little eddies in the field. But if you look at this, they're all going to be going around this outer loop. So you will have on the outer loop sort of a field that's going to be doing this, and you can imagine that the vector field dotted into DL is going to clearly be non-zero. And as this curls more and more in here, you're going to have a bigger value there. So just to help make it seem plausible to you. Okay? So that's Stokes' theorem. So let's see what we want to do with Stokes. So let's start with Faraday's law, where we have the integral over the curve of E dot dl is equal to minus d phi m over dt. Which is minus the derivative with respect to time of the integral of b dot dA over the surface. Now I want to rewrite the left-hand side of Faraday's law using using Stokes' theorem. So this piece then becomes, using Stokes' theorem, the integral over the surface of the curl of E dotted into dA. That's going to be equal to minus the derivative with respect to time of the integral of B dot dA over the surface. So this is the same integral here and here. I can pull this derivative in, because it's with respect to time and not with respect to area. And then I can set the two equal to each other, so the insides. So we have the curl of E is equal to minus the derivative of B with respect to time. That is the differential form of Faraday's law. It's the surface subtended by that curve. And although my intuition is always in a plane for that, I don't think it's confined to be on a plane. I think it can be any shape. All right. Now let's go and look at Ampere's law. The integral of B dot dl around a curve is equal to mu zero times I enclosed, which is the integral of around the surface, through the surface of J dot dA. So we've seen it. And then we added Maxwell's displacement current just a little while ago. So that's mu zero times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of the integral of E dot dA over the surface. So we can take this and use Stokes and change the integral of B dot dl to the integral over the surface or of the curl of B dotted into dA and the other side stays the same. And the areas that we're integrating over are the same in all three terms. So again, we can integral variable here is not the same as what we're taking the derivative here. So we can pull the derivative inside. We can't move it to the other side of E, but we can pull it inside, and we can then basically set the inside of each of these terms, the inside of each integral and the terms equal to each other. So we get del cross B is equal to mu 0 times j hat plus mu 0 times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of E hat, of E. And in fairness, probably up here, we've probably written this as a straight derivative, but it's really a partial derivative because B could be a function of different things. So probably what I want to do here is to make these partials because I've probably been a bit lax on that earlier. Okay. Let me just remind you. Change to partial . All right, I don't want you to get confused, but basically we should have had it as partial derivative throughout, but when you're introducing it, you sort of don't usually want to bring in that complication at that early stage, and then you get used to writing it that way. But strictly speaking, we should have been having that as a partial derivative. And now it becomes important. All right, so this then is Ampere's law in differential form. Okay? Alright, so for completeness, I'm just going to throw these all on one slide. Right? Don't know if I can remember them all. So we have del cross E. I'm sorry, we want to start with divergence. Del dot E is equal to rho over epsilon naught. Del dot B is equal to zero. And then we have the two curl equations. Del cross E is equal to minus derivative of B with respect to time, and we have del cross B is equal to mu 0 times J plus mu 0 times epsilon naught derivative with respect to time of E. And these are together Maxwell's equations in differential form. Ta-da. Ta-da. Okay. All right. So I can tell from your stunning reaction to this that you're wondering why you should give a crap. Integral form, differential form. Man, I'm not even used to all these dells, so why do I care? So I will now show you why you care. We're going to use this form and begin to ask what's really tied up in these equations, okay? So, what I'd like to do is to start with the bottom here, and I want to go into a region where there are no currents. So all I'm saying is J is zero. So that gets rid of this term. These are absolute and general, okay? When you say electromagnetism, it's all in there, right? Now, I'm about to show you what that really means when you say it's all in there. There's a lot of stuff, but everything we've learned up till now is actually tucked in those four equations, all right? And there's a lot of information here just to give you a little bit of a preview. Lots of derivatives in here. Lots of derivatives in here. E is coupled to B. B is coupled to E. Okay? And then you have, you know, sort of the nature of the field itself tucked in here. So there's coupling between E and B that's hidden in here, and there's time dependence and spatial dependence, because this is spatial dependence, that's time dependence. Right? So there's a lot of stuff that's tied in these equations. All right, so let's start out by assuming that we're in a region with no current. So this isn't completely general, this particular piece, right? So we now say that del cross B is equal to mu zero times epsilon naught times the derivative of E with respect to time. Next step, I want to take the curl of both sides. So if I do that, then I take the curl of the curl. Remember, the curl of B is a vector, so I can take the curl of it. Of course, now my intuition's totally blown out of the water, right? You have the circulation, but now you're taking the circulation of the circulation, which is a little bit weird. Okay. And that's going to be equal to mu zero times epsilon naught, which are just constants, so they pull out of the derivative or the curl or whatever we want to do. The curl, remember, involves spatial derivatives, but it has nothing to do with time, so we can actually pull it inside the time derivative on the right-hand side. You okay with that? Then magic happens, and we have a vector calculus identity, which is the curl of the curl of B is equal to the gradient of the divergence of B minus the divergence of the gradient of B. Okay, and that is not intuitive. I think is 217, is that quantum or E&M? Whichever one it is, the 230, my guess is you might get the fun of like deriving this one when you get to that class. But the point of this is I want you to see this stuff, but I don't want to drag you through these kinds of things. We could go through the process of, okay, today we're going to learn vector calculus derivations and make you do this for fun. I'll probably just save that for the final. But no. Only if I'm in a particularly perverse mood. Okay, so here, the divergence of B is zero. So that gets rid of that term. And this piece is something which we call the Laplacian of B. Get used to it. And because this is sort of annoying to write, we're going to write this as del squared B. All right. So this is complicated because Laplacians, you can take a Laplacian of both a vector field or a scalar field. Yeah. Because, so I need to tell you what I really mean when I say that. You'll see Laplacians a lot, okay, for whatever it's worth. This is a touching moment. Your first Laplacian. Put it on your calendar, celebrate it every year. Okay, so here we have our Laplacian. I'm going to define what we mean when we say a Laplacian of a scalar field. Remember, a scalar field is just a field like a temperature that has no direction, just magnitude. Then we take del squared of the scalar field is going to be equal to del dotted into the gradient of the scalar field. So that's really sort of what we were just writing, except it's a scalar instead of a vector. But the gradient of a scalar, all right, so what is that? We have I hat times the derivative with respect to x plus j hat. Actually, let me move this at least. Times the derivative with respect to y plus k hat times the derivative with respect to z. So that is this del. And we want to dot that into the gradient of t. The gradient is I hat times the derivative of t with respect to x plus j hat times the derivative of t with respect to y plus k hat times the derivative of t with respect to z. Okay? Now we do the cross multiplication. This term times that term is not zero because this I hat dotted into that I hat is one. So this is going to be the second derivative of t with respect to x. This term, cross multiplied with this term or that term, will be zero because I hat is orthogonal to j hat and k hat. Similarly, this term multiplying the second term here is going to give you a second derivative term multiplied by one. But this term multiplied by the first or third terms in that second piece over here is going to give you zero. Right, so what you end up with is the Laplacian of the scalar field T is equal to the sum of the second derivatives of the different components of the scalar field T. Okay. So that's the Laplacian of the scalar field. Life is not so easy. because even though I wrote B here as a scalar, it's not. In fact, this is a bit weird because I'm talking about taking the gradient of a vector. So that's a little bit strange. So we define the Laplacian of a vector field V it is taking the Laplacian of each component of the vector field, right? The component of the vector field in the x direction is a scalar. Right, at each point, what makes it a vector field is you have the three scalar components that are mapped together. And they all can vary from point to point, so there's a correlation between where you are and what those pieces are. But at a given point, each individual component is nothing but a scalar. So I can, as you've seen, take the Laplacian of a scalar. So when I talk about the Laplacian of a vector field, I am taking the Laplacian of the x component and multiplying it by I hat, the Laplacian of the y component of the vector field, multiplying it by j hat, and the Laplacian of the x component, I'm sorry, the z component, and multiplying it by k hat. So this is a bit strange also because I've sort of taken a well-defined Laplacian here, here, and here, and I've constructed a vector out of those pieces. Okay? What time do you have? I mean, this says 12:17. This says 17. It's a little fast, right? Because my watch, which I think is like 15. Okay, it makes a difference because what I need to do next. You know, right now we're about to jump into a pit of mud, and from that mud will emerge a beautiful flower. But I fear right now if we jump, we're going to be swimming in the mud when I have to stop the class, and you will not see the flower before you leave. And I don't want to leave you in that state. So I'm going to stop here, and we will jump in the mud and let the flowers emerge next Tuesday after your fine exams. Now, let me just give you, I understand that you may wish to, some of you may decide that your brain is dead and you want to skip class next time because we just had this exam. Don't. Don't, because the flower that we're about to get is really pretty, and you really don't want to miss this. Okay, it's very nice.